Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealth-club.org. I'm Courtney Cochran, owner of Your Personal Sommelier and Hip Tastes. The Fresh Guide to Wine is my book, published by Viking in 2007, and I'm your moderator for tonight's program. So tonight we're diving into a really fun topic in urban wineries. One of the things that was interesting to me on the introduction materials and the marketing materials for the event was that the panelists were introduced as winemaking magicians, or wizards, and I laughed because I think it's apt. I think that there is definitely something a little bit magical about winemaking. In that spirit, let's introduce our panelists. We have Derek Rolfs, who's the proprietor and winemaker of Bravian Wines on Treasure Island. We have Sasha Verhage. Am I saying that correctly?
Any attempt gets extra credit.
That's great. That's perfect.
Winemaker and proprietor of Oakland's Eno Wines. Christopher Lynch, winemaker and co-founder of Temescal Creek Urban Vintners, here in the middle. Welcome.
Yep.
We have Marilee Schaefer of Oakland's Urban Legend Cellars, winemaker and proprietor, right here.
Hello, Courtney.
Welcome, Marilee. Nice to have you. And we have Carl Sutton, last but not least, owner and winemaker of San Francisco Sutton Cellars, just here to my right.
Good evening.
So the topic of urban wineries, with a little bit of magic on top. I'm going to get things started with a question that I think is appropriate because we have to talk about location, right? Location, location, location. So my first question to you guys, panelists. Before we get started, I want to take a couple minutes and have you just share a few things about your experience. Let me just back up for a quick second. I'm getting too eager. I actually would like you guys to say a few words, if you would, about your business, your background, and if you could also tell us about one light bulb moment you've had as a winemaker. Let's start with Derek.
All righty. Thank you, Courtney, and thank you all for giving us such a nice welcome. I'm guessing it has nothing to do with the fact that we'll be pouring our wines for you later, right? So that said, a little background on me. I'm a Californian, native Californian. I was born in Pasadena. I went to college at UC Santa Barbara, did their environmental studies program, and I parlayed that into a marketing career that lasted about 15 years. And somehow found my way up to Northern California about 12 years ago and started making wine. Took courses at Davis. Did a little bit of trial and error. And ended up about 3 years ago on Treasure Island. Has anyone ever been to Treasure Island here? A few of you? All right. That's a lot of you, actually. Surprised it's that many. But you all know where it's located. It's just off the Bay Bridge, right in the middle of the bay. And it's a great location. We're talking about urban wineries today, and we're bringing the wineries to the population centers, right? So we're bringing our wineries closer to you. We're also bringing the grapes in to process the fruit and work with the fruit closer to these population centers. And I live in San Francisco, so as far as I'm concerned, it's a great place to have a winery and make wine.
It sounds great. Can you tell us quickly about your light bulb moment as a winemaker? Has there been a certain moment where you really felt like there was magic happening or it was worth the sacrifice?
See, I was hoping you were going to forget about that part. I don't know if I could pinpoint just one moment or one thing, but I would say what has been a light bulb for me over time is that oftentimes less is more. That's really more a philosophy maybe than a light bulb moment.
Sure.
But that's really an approach that I've always philosophically been open to, but I find that it's playing out even more the longer I make wine.
Okay.
So less is more. That's my light bulb.
Thanks for that. Appropriate for so many things in life, right? Okay, Sasha.
I'll start with the light bulb, I guess. One thing that surprised me is how close I need to be and partnered with the grape growers. I never thought I'd have to date them or court them or any of that. But there's definitely, you can't make great wine without great grapes, and you really need to have a great connection with the grape grower. And it almost is like you're going to go on a road trip with them. You have to be able to get along, speak the same language. You might have different focuses, but I think it's really, really important to cement that, because if they're just forgetting about the grapes and not communicating it to you, then guess what? September, October rolls around, and the grapes don't look so good, and you're not going to make great wines. So that was an epiphany to me of really looking at it holistically. Of course, we know great wines come from great vineyards, but building and cementing that relationship. And I can say all of my growers fit that category of people I want to go on road trips with. So they're pretty remarkable people. A little bit about Eno Wines. It started in my flat in San Francisco in 1999 as a home winemaker. Did some fermentations in our flat, and then slowly started getting more into it. And
did you have a permit for that?
No, definitely not. My roommates were pretty happy about it, though. Especially, they were a little upset it takes a year for them to actually taste it, but we sampled a lot along the way. But started in 99, 2001, I became an assistant winemaker and started my own brand, I guess commercially, and then 2003 is when I feel like I really started with all the vineyards and varietals that I wanted to work with.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.
Christopher.
Hi.
Light bulb moment.
Light bulb already. I was trying to figure out if I'm saying the name of my winery correctly after everybody's changing it, but it's Temescal Creek is the way we're saying it, so we'll go with that. You can say it any way you want. So I think we're true urban winemakers. I make wine with my friends in the back there and my wife right in the backyard, right in Oakland, right by Temescal, which is not the lake, but there's actually a creek over there. So we're really small. We're just making about 50 cases of wine. So the light bulb moment is just to try to figure out how do I get to be like my colleagues here on the panel and make a little bit more, but not go overboard and still keep with the quality. And that's really our focus on the fruit and the quality of the wine.
Terrific. And can you tell us a little bit more about your background and how you came to be making 50 cases of wine in your backyard?
Yeah, it's really related to we drink a lot of wine. So we found ourselves drinking our really good stuff and not having anything left over. So Greg and I and my wife and Kim, we all decided to just start making our own. So I started taking classes at UC Davis, although we were making wine throughout that. So I go to an enology program at Davis. It's an online program, pretty basic, but you learn enough to get by.
Terrific. Marilee.
Okay, the light bulb. Nothing you ever learn goes to waste. It will crop up in the most amazing places, and you will never expect that you will need to know that ever again. So that said, Urban Legend's first commercial crush was 2008, after some years as garagistes, much to the entertainment of our neighbors.
Sounds so much better in French. Thank
Doesn't
you, Marilee.
Doesn't it? It always does. Garagiste, much to the entertainment of the neighborhood children who used to come and get grape juice, much to the chagrin of their parents after they were bouncing off the walls because it was unexpectedly sweet.
But it's okay because it was French.
Yeah.
Way back. Urban Legend is my husband and myself, and we could best be described, I think, as serial entrepreneurs, which is something like describing yourself as a serial murderer. You know, it's with better social acceptance. Serial murderers are very passionate about what they do. They get a little obsessed sometimes. And I think serial entrepreneurs are that way. My background is high tech via biotechnology, via medical research. Steve's background is via high tech, via electronics. And so in the department of everything you learn comes back again and nothing goes to waste. The catapult that got me into the technology of making wine before I went back and did a little tune-up at Davis the same way that Christopher here did, was that my summer job during college was as a field microbiologist and field chemist in a corn syrup factory back in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And while, you know, at this point, my conclusion is that the stuff's poison, it did teach me all the skills and analyticals that I use day in, day out in the winery.
So from high fructose to hot juice, like...
Exactly.
I like this evolution. You're on the right path.
Yeah, and a lot of organic grape growers, you know, who would shudder to see what came in the doors of that corn syrup factory. So, you know, it's a real evolution. Steve and I literally use our skills every day between winemaking, between building out a winery, which Steve designed and in many cases did all the work himself down to the last electron, to building our own casework in the tasting room. All of that are things that we've learned over time and we've brought back together again. So as a project that we said, okay, we've got one more startup in us, what's it going to be and what can we do together, rather than deferring the dream, buying, selling out everything, buying a vineyard somewhere and moving to the country, we said, let's stay where we love and let's do it now. And that's the evolution of Urban Legend. And by the way, our you'll see on our labels the symbol of our neighborhood. We're right down on the docks, not far away from the Port of Oakland. And that's one of those big container cranes. And everybody comes up to us and says, oh, did you know that George Lucas used those container cranes as the example for designing the Imperial Walkers in the second Star Wars movie? And we just smirk and say, Urban Legend.
Well played.
That was very well played, to Carl's point. Can we just back up for a second, though? Did you truly, in the beginning of that, compare a serial entrepreneur to a serial killer? Because I was like, I thought your name was Marilee Schaefer, but maybe it's Marilee Manson, and we had a mistype here.
I did say that it had better social acceptance.
This is true.
But a lot of the same characteristics.
All right, let's move on that note. To Carl Sutton, to my right here.
All right, so as of this month, I have spent exactly half of my life in the wine business, so I guess I have to say at this point that is my background. I got my first job in the wine business in 1990, and as the logical extension of a hobby, making wine at home, as well as just the career path that I was on, in 1996 I started Sutton Cellars. It spent 12 years in Sonoma County, 2 years in Novato in a shared facility, and then finally my own space in San Francisco as of about a year and a half ago. Let's see, the light bulb moment for me, location, Dog Patch. If any of you know the Dog Patch neighborhood, it's sandwiched in between AT&T Park and what's probably a better known neighborhood, Bayview, Hunters Point. It's a part of the city that's still very industrial. There's a lot of manufacturing. There's a lot of small businesses there. There's a lot of people that make things and interface with their customers on a very personal level. And the neighborhood, as well as the greater part of the city, is very welcoming in that respect. And that's been one of the best things about moving down to that location. The light bulb moment, there are light bulb moments all the time. There are aha moments. I think, and I've said this differently, but I think if those light bulb moments stop happening, I will probably get out of the wine business and do something else, because it can be very rewarding and very stimulating. If I had to pick one, I think it's when you're standing in front of a customer and they appreciate your efforts. And they appreciate the effort to the point where they want to buy it. I think that's really, as long as that light bulb keeps going off, that's all right.
Uh-huh. We like that light bulb.
Yeah.
The commerce light bulb makes everything keep going. Yeah. Okay, so now that we're more acquainted with our panelists, our magician winemakers, let's move into the question I initially posed about location and identity, really. This is a question about how you see yourself and how you hope others see you. So in the absence of a traditional place for winemaking, which has always been thought of as wine country, right, do you feel an imperative to tell your story more often or differently than a traditional winery might? For example, when you go to wine country, the story in a lot of ways is already put in place, right? The mise en place is there. You have the winery, you have the vineyards, you have the countryside. People understand, but that's not the case with an urban winery. So I know that some of you make a point of being storytellers in your sort of brand proposition, if you will, and I'd love to hear more about how that all comes together, especially as regards identity. So why don't we start with Carl? Switch things up a little bit.
All right. As I mentioned, the neighborhood that I'm in has a lot of small businesses, a lot of people that are into food and into wine and also into knowing where the products that they purchase come from. One of the events that I've started doing at the winery is called Jug Sundays. And this kind of harkens back to the day when you could take a container to a winery and have them refill it for you. It's still very common in France, Italy, and Spain. You go to the local cooperative. Even retail stores are set up like this. What we do is we have a food truck or a pop-up restaurant or a food purveyor of some sort that comes and serves food. You can purchase food, bring it into the winery. I don't need to have a restaurant license or permit or anything like that. They're all legal. People can buy wine. Our license allows us to sell wine by the glass and by the bottle for consumption on premise. And we do it Sunday afternoons from 2 till 5 p.m. We get a great turnout for it. And I think that in the neighborhood that I'm in, it's helping to build a certain sort of community because we're a little bit landlocked. We don't have a lot of the normal services such as grocery stores that you would have in a neighborhood. So you either need to get on public transportation or you need to get in your car or you need to bike somewhere. And a lot of the people that live in the lofts nearby, we're right by the Caltrain station at 22nd. And we have a lot of people that live in the neighborhood and maybe commute down the peninsula. This is something that they can walk to in their neighborhood, and it's really it's been very well received as something that's building community. And we're trying to do more and more of that. Another thing that we just had at the winery was an underground dining group with dinner for 55. And the people are not told the location of the dinner until the morning of. And seeing people's eyes kind of light up when they walk in the door of this very huge, the building that I'm in is 300,000 rentable square feet. I only have 3,200 of it. There's all kinds of businesses in there. But to see this very massive, two-city block-sized concrete nondescript building, and people walk through that door and they see tables set and chefs in their whites and wine barrels everywhere, really kind of a mind-blower. So I think part of what the urban winery allows is that people find something that they really didn't expect.
I like that. So a story of surprise.
Yep.
In a different setting. Merrily.
Well, you know, the French have a word. I'm going to do French again. Terroir. And terroir is one of those ones words that have sort of a sticky meaning to pin down. But in the context of wine, my interpretation of terroir is a sense of place that's communicated from the bottle. The wine communicates about itself and its sense of place that way. That's its terroir. Now, when you're an estate winery linked to a piece of land, the concept of terroir, particularly as the French see it, is a little more certain. But when we started to ask ourselves, okay, what was our terroir, given that there are, you know, 8 or 10 different vineyards that we work with, and if you draw a ring around California with Oakland at the center, we kind of hit that radius. So we had to say, what is our terroir? What is our sense of place? And that really started us thinking hard about, you know, what that was going to be. And so that dictated some things like the image of the container cranes, that it's our locale. You know, no gold writing, no burgundy and cream labels. We're a city people, and we're a little bit edgy. Because we're in a neighborhood, Carl brought up an excellent point. In Europe, in Italy and France in particular, people are used to making wine part of their daily life by going down to the co-op, picking up their table wine in their jug, taking it home. And, you know, when you drive 90 miles to wine country to do that, it's not an everyday thing. And so we, too, do a refillable container program with wines that are named, blends that are good for the table that are named for different Oakland neighborhoods, Uptown, Ironworks, West O's coming up, and, you know, matching the flavor of the neighborhood with the flavor of the wines is an interesting sort of challenge. But we've worked very hard, you know, to become part of the neighborhood, to become part of everyday life, and to be true to where we are rather than trying to communicate that we're not what we are. You know, the best way to locate us, aside from the fact that we're down near the Port of Oakland, is that we're at the place where BART across the street goes underground coming out of West Oakland. And so we have BART trains in the background. You know, that's not your typical bucolic wine country image. So we try to stay true to where we really are.
It sounds like you've kind of nicely superimposed your urban identity on the traditional wine country identity with your names and whatnot. And you're working with it.
Well, we're working with it, and one of, I think, the things that's most important to us, whether it comes down to the marketing side, brand, image, packaging, which, frankly, is the reality of the business, you know, to the craft of winemaking and the art of it as well, is that we wanted to stay genuine in terms of what we were doing, that the wines were genuine, representative of the places that they were grown, the varietals that they were, and that our image accurately reflected what we really were.
Yeah. Thank you. So I want to move this one forward a little bit because we have a lot of questions to go through. So Christopher, if you could, I'm going to have the three of you run through this one. And the subsequent questions I'm going to pose just kind of to the panel so we can get our pace moving a bit. But I'd love for you guys to all address this one because it is an important question. Christopher from Temescal.
Exactly.
You have the floor.
And what am I talking about now? can I first one up these guys? Because
you can do whatever you want. You have the floor.
Which is pretty tough, and you're down by BART. But we're right off of Highway 24. In fact, Highway 24, if you threw your coffee cup out the window, it would land in the winery there. So we're pretty
awesome.
Urban, though.
Don't try that.
Yeah.
So I forgot the question, though.
Well, I mean, in some ways, you have answered it. I really wanted you to tell us how you envision your story as something different from the traditional wine country story.
Sure.
And
sure, the story is great. We love telling it, too. And I think it really relates to what we see in the food business, the revolution there for the last, you know, 40, 50 years. And why don't we do it with the wine? I mean, we can have great wine, great local wine, and as we do with our food. So that's really sort of a mantra that we're striving for to get to. We're not really selling our wines yet, but once we do, it'll be totally local, and it hopefully supports this local focus on wine and food.
Sure. You're the ultimate DIY. You're making your own wine in your backyard.
And for pizzas too. Yeah, we got everything.
And a pizza oven. So for all of you who have thriving backyard gardens and pizza ovens, now you have to make wine. So you know. Sasha.
And I think you're in my backyard too. I'm in 60th Street by Wood Tavern. Well, just I'll try to be as quick as possible. I grew up in Michigan. My parents bought a lot of wine at Costco. Good wine was cheap wine. Cheaper the better. And I started looking at the labels when I got into wine, and they were all the same. Scripty, font, chateau, blah, 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 usually named after their first, second, or third wife. And, you know, it was the same adjectives on the back all the time. And they just took white out every year, 2001, 2002, 2003. It was boring. And when I started making wine, I was like, I'm on pins and needles looking at the weather report every October or September and October. Is there going to be rain? Is there going to be no rain? Is this going to happen? That going to happen? you know, what is the impact of El Nino or the late rains in June, you know, with flowering? There, people are trying so hard every year to give birth to these grapes. And I'm trying something as a winemaker, as a creator, as a magician. And I want to bring that story to the people. Because when they give a bottle of my wine or when they go to a dinner party, they don't want to say, oh, I got this at Costco. I hope you like it. They want to say, no, I went to Dry Creek. I met Ray Teldesky's dad, who's 95, Mike Teldesky. He planted the vineyard, you know, 85 years ago. He can walk through each one of these vines and tell you a story about each one of them. The time Ray was learning how to go on an ATV, fell over and cracked one of the, you know, branches or the, you know, they were head pruned. But anyway, you know, you want to tell that story.
Details,
that,
details.
Yes, people want that story. And I think people connect to that. And I think my goal as an artist is to bring people closer to that. So we change the label every year, the design every year. We come up with evocative names to tell that story behind that. So I hope that was short enough.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. On the end.
Yes.
Bring it home.
Well, Sasha's mentioned twice now how important growers are in what we do as urban winemakers because we don't have these huge vineyards located at the winery. And I think from my perspective, that's one of the great things about being located, having Bravium located on Treasure Island is because we're surrounded by all the vineyards we work with. We were talking earlier about our Pinot Noir vineyard up in Anderson Valley, up in Mendocino. We have Pinot Noir vineyards in Sonoma Coast and near Pingrove, if any of you know that area. Carneros in Napa. We've gotten fruit in the past from Paso Robles, Santa Lucia Highlands, you know, to the south. So we're kind of in the epicenter of the vineyards that we work with. So from my perspective, that's a, you know, part of what we are and what we do. From a customer's perspective, there are now four wineries on Treasure Island. And I hear tell that there are two more that are going to open soon. So we're now, you know, we're a wine destination. So people can come to, we are. You heard it here first.
Yeah.
So people will visit us where we're a collective just within our little location. We're four wineries under one roof. And then there are three other wineries they can visit while they're on the island. And so it's a reason to come out to the island and enjoy a day of wine tasting.
Yeah. It's definitely a new kind of identity, the island state of mind. All right. So I think that one of the things that's, to me, most compelling about the urban winery business model or proposition, if you will, is the flexibility that's inherently a part of it. So Carl, you know, has talked about the wines that he produces, which can vary from year to year, as representative of his entire body of work. And he said to me that he knows that his customers appreciate that he has different products every year and that they recognize they're part of, there's a common thread linking them all. So that's one example of the kind of creativity and flexibility that you can have, not just as an urban winery, but that does seem to be sort of inherently lent to the model. With Eno Wines, I know that you guys have radically different labels each year. Which is really compelling. So this is, again, not totally unique to the urban winery model to be so so iterative, if you will, with your products. But certainly compared to traditional wineries that own their own vineyards or have long-term vineyard contracts where you are really you're in a box in a way and that you need to produce wine from those same parcels each year. The other side of this flexibility and creativity is how do you handle the customer expectations? It's, you know, one of the things that is convenient about having the same fruit to work with every year is that people know what to expect, right? They know that you're always going to release an X wine each year, and they oftentimes look forward to it and buy it in turn. So the sales process is a little bit different. There are lots of things that I think are inherently challenging about doing business this way, but there are a lot of opportunities for creativity. So I just wanted to see if the panel, if there's anyone who wants to kind of speak to that, or if this strikes your fancy as something that you can chat about in the context of what you've done.
Well, Steve often says when he's done some press that, you know, people often always ask the first question, why in Oakland? And he says, what better place than Oakland? You draw that circle for 2 hours around you, and you have all the best viticultural areas in California, in our opinion. You also can go where you think it grows the best, and that liberates you from being tied to a certain varietal. You know, for example, we love how they grow Barbera in the Sierra foothills, but it wouldn't be a very good crop if, even though we love it to death, if we were tied to a piece of land in Carneros. By the same token, when we said, okay, we'd love to do some Pinot Noir, you know, and we could take advantage of Russian River or Sonoma Mountain or Carneros fruit, we say, style-wise, Carneros suits us the best. And so the whole process is being able to say, okay, where do they grow it the best? Where do the grapes grow that lend themselves best to the style of winemaking that we have? We tend to like things that will fit well with food, more wines for the table than the cocktail glass, I guess would be the best way to put it. But we have that flexibility to go. And so then there's a lot of good fruit grown in California. We have the flexibility to find the people with whom we can have the best relationship, because at the end of the day, as has been said over and over and over again, you know, it's all about the relationship with the grower in terms of the quality of the crop that's produced. And if the quality isn't there, then it's very, very difficult to do winemaking as an art and a craft, and it becomes a big chemistry experiment, which is not really what we like to be able to do. You know, when I took viticulture in the Davis program, I don't know who you had for your viticulture instructor, but mine said, always find a grower that knows more about growing grapes than you do, and that's been a guiding principle we've used in selecting as well. And it's not as unusual as you might think to find growers that don't.
I'd like to add something to that. Something I like to constantly remind people of is that, and I think it's important to this conversation, there are three really important segments to what most of you might think of as a winery. And that's an agricultural interest, that's a farm that's growing grapes. There's a food processing interest, which I'm going to be as unromantic as I can be here. It's kind of the same as making ketchup. You're taking an agricultural product and you're transforming it so that you can package it, transport it, and consume it later. And then the third entity is that marketing arm. So everyone that's up here has the ability to focus on those last two things. People will come into the winery all the time and say, where are your vineyards? I'll say, I'm not a vineyard. I'm a winery. I know how to drive a tractor. I know how to prune a vine. I know how to do all that kind of stuff. That doesn't mean I'm the best person for it. So not having that burden allows me to go out and find the best source of fruit possible, and also allows me, on the other side, to concentrate more on marketing. And I think in terms of, as in my case, making different wines from year to year, you can sort of train your customers to expect things. They might say, well, I know what you do is good. It's not going to be the exact same thing as last year, but then you don't eat the same thing for dinner every night. So, yes, you might want some consistency, but I think you can learn to expect that from the brand rather than just having to have a Pinot Noir or a Cabernet or whatever, X wine, as Courtney said, year after year after year.
Yeah, and I think that especially as we like more and more change, we seem to be the in the era of rapid change. I think there's an inherent sort of sensibility that matches, which is nice, because the wine industry has for so long been about one product each year or a suite of the same products. Let's move on. I think that one thing that probably a lot of you out there are wondering about is career. From a career perspective, are you guys working on this as your full-time engagement, or are you an urban winemaker / tech marketing guru, and how do you make it all work?
I'm unemployable elsewhere.
Yeah.
So, not lifer.
That's why we're here, because I'm manifestly unemployable. But, no, I'm full-time with the winery and full-time with a second business in a different field, which means that I either am 200% committed or should be.
Sasha, I saw you. Oh. Christopher.
this is totally part-time, little time for me, although I want it to go the other way. So I'm in the financial services business in San Francisco, and I need to get out of that. This is my only way out.
Not the most comfortable sector to be in at this time, for sure. Sasha.
Yeah, I do have a day job. It's in high tech, and that is my paycheck. My passion is wine and winemaking, and I was hoping in 2006 to get away from high tech and move into wine and winemaking full time. But as I left my previous job, which was at Yahoo, I got the day after I left, I got a call from Google. And they said, well, come talk to us, and I'm sure we could work something out during harvest. And so they've let me have flex time during that time, because they really encourage people to follow their passions, and they think that that's where true innovation comes from, is when people are in that zone. So that is my current profession, or my day job, which is at Google.
Are they hiring? Can I?
Yes, yes. Well, we have so many. They feed us breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Have great chefs from all over. And I've been trying to become the chief winemaker, but I think we have to move a little bit, you know, along.
Work on those employee dining room wine pairings.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
I think you'd have a lot of support probably if you were able to get them to install that position.
I hope so. I know some folks there that. Make wine.
Would appreciate it.
Yeah.
The fringe benefits.
Yeah.
Quick answer. I have a marketing company, so I do still have a marketing. I'm a marketeer by profession. The winemaking is more of a passion. I'd say most days making wine are better than most days doing the marketing work, and I find myself spending more time at the winery. Than I do with the marketing stuff. So.
Sure, but no doubt helpful, I'm sure,
yeah.
In the wine business.
Comes in handy.
Be a crack marketer. I want to talk a little bit about sustainability as regards this business model. Merrily, on your website, there was a quote that I liked, which was, grapes care a lot about where they're made, but don't care much about where they're made into wine. And we can credit that to Brendan of Periscope Cellars. Is he here? All right, well, we're celebrating him all the same. So the value chain for winemaking no longer needs to be a mile long, right? Urban wineries are running tighter and leaner ships. And these advantages also accrue to the environment. I'd love for you guys to share a little bit about how that is the case in your endeavors. If it is, hopefully it is.
I'll throw something out there about the Jug Sunday events that we do. In terms of sustainability, we're getting rid of packaging, that one-time use cork, foil, bottle, and label. It's a refillable container that people can bring back. They pay a $3 deposit on it. So that's something that I can add into the cost, or rather subtract from the cost of what I'm charging people for that wine. The other thing that's great, when I had the winery up in Petaluma, I was always concerned about people driving home from events. And I always wanted people to have a good time, but also be careful and respectful of others as well as themselves on the road. We have 3 Muni lines, which, you know, it may take you an hour to get home on Muni, but you don't have to drive.
Yeah, and I'm going to prompt you just a little bit, Merrily, because I saw on your website that it's your opinion that trucking the grapes to your urban winery to then make the wine and bottle it there actually has a lower carbon footprint than having the wine bottled in wine country and then shipped to consumers, because the packaging for the wine as a finished product is so heavy with the glass bottles and whatnot. Perhaps you can speak a little bit to that.
Well, disclaimer, I haven't done the math completely on it, but by inspection, we'll say that's the case. You leverage... by shipping grapes, it's actually fairly economical in terms of a truckload of 3 or 5 tons of grapes that come down and get processed into wine. If that wine is either in refillable containers, which we do some kegs for restaurants as well, or locally delivered and consumed. So, you know, part of the model that we were looking at is that, you know, rather than trucking people around to get to visit the winery and finding it. They're here already. You know, so we're where the people are, we're where the restaurants are, we're where the consumer is. And so we're not sending now this heavy packaging all around and in lightly loaded, not as economically driven vehicles, perhaps. So we think that if we did sit down and do the math, that that would be a better leveraging of certainly fuel and, you know, people resources as well. So, you know, it made some sense to us to do the production where the people were. And if you look back historically, food processing businesses, certainly in Oakland, were there literally to serve the local people. You know, there's still a flour factory not too far from us that largely services the bakeries and the food producers in the local area. You know, it used to be a much more distributed manufacturing scenario until gasoline got so inexpensive we had interstate highways to truck everything around and we went to huge central processing. You know, it also brings people closer to the craft, and I think that, you know, if you want to look at society and what it's craving, I think that attachment back to the production of their goods and the craftsmanship that goes into it's pretty important these days. I think there's a real thirst for that. And having the winery where the people are helps quench some of that.
Yeah. I'd like to ask a question about inspiration. Being in an urban environment with its vagaries and fabulous elements all together, how does this inspire you?
I'll speak to that, I guess. It's great to have such a proximity to all of my restaurant accounts and all of my direct-to-consumer, my customers, that I didn't have before. There was a disconnect having the winery up north, but living in the city and having all of my peers as well as the majority of my accounts being restaurants and retailers, they can all come and visit the winery now. There's no excuse if a team of wait staff from a restaurant wants to come by and do some barrel tasting or, you know, learn about new releases. I can actually have them come to the winery. I don't have to go to the expense of having them rent a vehicle or get them all together and drive them an hour and a half outside of the city to do that. It keeps me a little bit more nimble. There's also always, if you have a wine on a glass list, meaning being poured by the glass, the restaurant will not call you Thursday afternoon to tell you that they are out. They will call you Friday afternoon to tell you that they are out, which means if your wine is up at the winery in Sonoma or Napa or wherever, you're not going to get it there in time. You're going to be fighting traffic, whereas I've delivered wine on Muni before because my wife had the car that day. And I'll probably do it again. Other than that, I think also the fact that the neighborhood that I'm in still has a very gritty side to it. We have the Hells Angels Clubhouse a block and a half in one direction. We have the impound yard and block in the other direction. Wednesdays is auction day, and there's always a very different side of society that comes out trying to purchase cars at auction. So there's still a part of that neighborhood that feels a little bit gritty. And I think that's kind of fun. And when people come out there, I think it lends a little sense of adventure to what they're doing.
Yeah, that sense of adventure, going to work on Sunday morning when the tasting room's going to open at noon and not knowing whether you're going to be pressure washing the graffiti off the side of the building or, you know, hosing off the doors because some homeless person has camped there and urinated on them. You know, it's a little bit of a different world that way.
Indeed. Thanks for these details, yeah. Matt.
Welcome to the hood, girl.
Yeah. Touché. I have a question from the audience that I'd like to integrate. And thank you, by the way, for your submissions. And if you do have other questions, please feel free to submit them, and I'll see where I can work them in. What effect does your urban location have on your wine's flavor, savor, and aroma? Interpret that as you will.
We get worried sometimes because Mr. Espresso's roasting facility is a block away, and when they vent the oak ovens, you know, it's kind of impossible to know that there are grapes in the building. It's just like, oh, there's major coffee overtones from the barrel in here.
Yeah, we haven't noticed anything special. We're right by the highway, like I said, and but under a beautiful eucalyptus tree. So if anything, the flavor of that might permeate. But you get the grapes brought in, and you don't. I don't think it affects the.
Well, you know, you can have. You make Cabernet, right?
That's right.
You can have aromas of eucalyptus and smoke in Cabernet. So,
well, that's
who's
that's,
to say where it's coming from, right?
That's my magic wand. Remember the beginning question?
See, magicians.
And while we make wine in North Berkeley, near Trumer Pills and Pyramid, we're sandwiched in between them. There are two other wineries there as well, and that's called, I guess it's being called the Disc or Drinks District. Some folks are doing native fermentations, which means you just leave the grapes there and let them ferment with the yeast that's on the skin, so it's native. I think that's somewhat problematic if you're sandwiched between two breweries that are pumping out yeast of different sorts. And so if you've got beer yeast, you have to be very mindful because they're not nearly as strong as wine yeast. So they will stop and you will suddenly have sweet wine. So I think you need to be mindful of that, or that's one thing that I'm very mindful of is the brewing days and what have you. So, again, each place has its own unique terroir, whether it's coffee or beer, but
maybe we're learning a little bit more than we wanted to, right?
Yeah.
Derek.
Yeah. As far as our location on Treasure Island, I think the most notable thing would be you've all heard that Mark Twain line: "Coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco." Well, we're right in the middle of that quote. So, in the summertime, the cool air rolls through it comes barreling through the Golden Gate, and the fog settles in over us. And so we're kind of this above ground on an island cave. We didn't have to drill into a hillside in Napa and spend $20 million to make our fancy cave. And it's humid, it's cool, it's pretty constant temperatures. We actually have fans in the roof of the winery that suck air into the facility. So we don't have air conditioning. We have natural fans bringing in cool air. So that would be how I'd speak to that
question.
That's
marvelous. Yeah. Thank you. So you were talking a little bit about challenges, and I have a question I wanted to ask you. I think in any endeavor that is outside the box or outside of the norm, where you're being somewhat of a pioneer, there are challenges. But I think that there are also glorious challenges. I think there are challenges that were unforeseen that may help you to be better and do things differently and actually create perhaps even a competitive advantage that's unique to where you are and what you're doing. But it could also be something small. And I wonder, do you have any glorious challenges that you have encountered along the way?
The wheels are turning. You can see it, huh?
Being very very urban and starting out just making wine for ourselves, we hardly have any equipment, no lab, no measurements of anything. So the challenge there is to still make a tasty wine that is balanced, and that's what we're learning every year. And we were inspired by a guy who I don't think he said he didn't do anything at all, you know, related to it. It was more like the natural yeast type of thing, but I don't believe him because his wines are really good.
He's a magician.
It may be. So we're taking it to the next step and just trying to actually monitor and manage it a little bit more. So the challenge of not having the equipment and the space, we're just trying to take it to the next stage. Still small lots, but understanding how the wine's made up.
Sure. Anyone else?
Our first crush in our facility, so all the equipment new to us, all the building new to us, and then we decide that we're also going to make Sauvignon Blanc, which we had never made white wine before. The challenge of the fruit arriving at 5 o'clock in the afternoon constituted what we called the Sauvignon Blanc all-nighter. Once you start to press, and it required 2 press loads, and there were some mechanical hiccups in between it, we started pressing about 6, and we went home and got showers the following morning. about 8 o'clock, just enough time to come back and open the other business that we have at the same location. So, you know, welcome to the joy of winemaking.
I'd say parking.
Yeah.
If you have a 22-foot flatbed truck with 5 tons of fruit on there and you're looking for a parking spot, good luck.
There's nothing glorious about that.
No.
And they're vicious with parking tickets in Oakland. You know, we've gotten tickets at 9 o'clock at night for parking in our own loading zone. So, you know, it's welcome to the city once again.
Yeah.
Truly. I know one of my favorite things about going to wine country is that I can actually park my car.
Yeah.
Plenty of parking in Dog Patch.
Every weekend. Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. There you go. I have another question from the audience. If your passion becomes tremendously successful, and I assume by passion this person means your business, does that put your business at risk in terms of the personal touch and variety that you bring to your customers?
Can I take that one?
Of course. Yeah.
So just to lend a little perspective and numbers to the conversation here, there are about, last I heard, there are about 5,500 bonded wineries in the U.S. Most of them are located in California, of course, right? The top three wine producers, you can't even call them wineries at that point, wine producers in the U.S. produce 50% of the wine that's domestically consumed. And the top 30 wine producers in the U.S. produce 90% of the wine that is domestically consumed. So you have a situation where 30 wine producers, you can carve out 90% of the market for them, and the other 5,000 plus wine producers, you can carve out 10% of the market for those folks, which we all fall into that group of 5,000, right? So just to add a little perspective, we're microscopic. We're really small, right? So successful, I think, to each of us would be a different thing, but a sustainable business, the ability to make the wines we want to make on an ongoing basis, that might, you know, I might get some nodding at that point, right? I don't think any of us aspire to be those top 30 brands anytime soon, right?
Sure.
So what we found is some of our wines do catch on more so than others. And those wines, we tend to try to get more fruit for those the next year if we can and feed it a little bit. But at the end of the day, we're still, I'd say, small and just looking to maybe not stay small forever, but grow organically and just become a viable, sustainable winery.
Can I take a little different stab at that?
Yes, you may.
I think one of the risks that you run being a small producer and operating completely out of passion is that there's the people who knew you when. And once you reach too big of an audience, they may reject you. It's just like finding a new band or finding a new artist or anything like that. People want to know about the little guy. And I'm not sure if that was the motivation behind the question, but you get to a point where you're making 500 cases and you're struggling, and finally you get to a point where you're making 1,000 cases or 2,000 cases and you're paying your bills and everything's going great. But those first few people, the first cool kids that really liked what you were doing, they're on to the next thing. But I think you also have to take that because you might lose touch with some of your customer base because it becomes popular to a broader range, a bigger audience. But that's okay if it pays the bills.
But Carl, does the wine suffer from making more, or are you still focused on?
In my case, quality? No. But I've seen that happen for sure to some producers.
In that sense, it's again to return to your perspective about that your output as sort of a body of work. And I do think that some people do approach these more boutique producers as you would follow an artist or you'd follow a band, if you will. And I think that that's part of the challenge that's presented to any kind of creative business that grows, any kind of business.
Well, it's the idea of building a brand. And you've got a couple of decisions that you can make. Personalities do indeed make businesses, but you know, if your brand, if you will, becomes too tightly linked with you, your personality, then there's a pitfall up the way that if success does happen and you have to grow it, how do you maintain that sense of contact? How do you maintain that sense of intimacy with the people who really support you?
A quick reminder for our audience, our radio audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club of California, and tonight we're hosting Urban Wine Uncorked with Derek Rolfs, proprietor and winemaker of Bravium Wines, Sasha Verhage, winemaker and proprietor for Eno Wines, Christopher Lynch, winemaker and co-founder of Temescal Creek Urban Vintners, Marilee Schaefer, winemaker and proprietor of Urban Legend Cellars, and Carl Sutton, owner and winemaker of Sutton Cellars. I'm Courtney Cochran with your personal sommelier. Let's talk a little bit about experience, the wine tasting experience. I'm sure that the audience knows quite a bit about this, if you're here this evening. People have long seen wine country as an escape from urban pressures. Do you try to emulate the traditional wine country experience in your tasting rooms? This is assuming that you have a tasting room. Do you try to go far away from it, or maybe perhaps to meet this old idea in the middle?
No. We are not like, and my first job in the wine business was in a tasting room. I was a tasting room manager for two locations, did the 5 tour buses a day, 40 people per bus. So I know that routine. And the location that I'm in now doesn't lend itself to that. We have a lot of families in the area that have small kids. They're really excited when we have our roll-up door open for our Sunday events. There's a killer ice cream shop down the street from us. They say, can we bring the kids in? Yeah, we're not a bar. We're a winery, so there's not a 21 and over limit. Great. We're going to go get the kids an ice cream cone, and we're going to come back, and Mom and Dad are going to have some wine. And when I see families getting into that, not having to hop in the car, they're just pushing the stroller a few blocks away. That's really fun. Give the kids some sidewalk chalk and let them color all over the floors. They love that. And we're definitely not trying to be that here's our flower garden, here's our horse stables, here's our vintage car collection. Those are all things that don't contribute anything to the taste of the wine. And we don't have any room for it anyways. It would get stolen if we had that kind of stuff.
I think I might have stolen some of that stuff. We surely don't have a tasting room, but we have a lot of friends, so all of a sudden we have more friends.
Right?
And we do a pretty cool tasting, and then naturally we roll into the winery and do a lot of barrel sampling. So I don't think we would ever want to recreate Napa Sonoma, but it's our own little version of it.
We do have a tasting room that we've tried to make comfortable. In that respect, we're a little bit like wine country, the other wine country, that is. What's different is that ours is open to the winery, so we have no secrets. You get to see what we're doing. And during crush, you're going to put up with forklifts, noise, hoses, people dressed inappropriately for wine service, if you will, mm-hmm. and all of that. But, that's sort of part of what we wanted to keep to with keeping it all genuine. We keep it pretty real. I think what our focus is that we have to keep remembering that no matter what the setting is that we're still offering hospitality to people. And for our customers, the focus has got to be on them, that this is a place where they can come and enjoy themselves for a little while. We love having a neighborhood who can walk there, faces we see regularly. But, with the number of wineries and tasting rooms that there are between Oakland, Berkeley, Emeryville, and Alameda, you can have a wine country weekend without leaving home. So, why not?
Well put. I have a few questions here that I'm going to condense into one question because we have just a few minutes left. They all come from the audience, and they all relate to grapes and grape sourcing. How does a small urban winemaker source good fruit in less than industrial volumes? And as an adjunct to that, I'd like to just toss on another one. How does the selection of your grape varieties change from year to year, and how do you determine your selection? So if anyone would like to take that.
When you first start out as a new winemaker, as an urban winery, I think it is challenging finding your grape sources. It's a little bit of networking. It's a little bit of hitting the websites in the industry that where people are looking to sell grapes. And maybe the first time you work with somebody, you might buy some fruit from them one time, kind of last minute right before harvest, and maybe get a deal on it. And then that goes well or it goes horribly wrong. And if it goes well, you stick with that person and maybe grow your relationship, or that person introduces you to someone else because they like the wines you produced. And then over time, it gets a lot easier to establish those relationships that are so important. Once you find a vineyard you love, I mean, my whole theory is, you know, buy up the whole thing. And because then once you're at that level working with somebody, you are able to work with them. We're up there on a weekly basis at our vineyards, working with the vineyard managers, working with the vineyard owners to try to have it farmed the way we want it to be farmed and make sure the fruit's going to come in the way we want the fruit to come in, because that's really between growing the fruit and making the pick decision. Those are the two biggest things I do as a winemaker. The rest of the stuff we do in the winery is, again, less is more, as hands-off as we can be.
I'm getting inspired by trying to make a connection in the vineyards. We buy our grapes from a third-party kind of a broker in Berkeley, so we don't really know where the grapes are coming from. I mean, we know they're Napa or Sonoma or Lodi, something like that, but we have no relationship with the grower. Hopefully this guy does. And it seems to be working all right, but this is I think it's the first stage in that home winemaking process, right? You don't want to go and spend a boatload of money up in the wine country to get some grapes when you're not really sure if you're going to get into it. So the next phase for us is to actually find that grower and find those relationships.
So I believe that your palate is what should guide you. And that's what I've trusted. That's what I offer to you guys. If you're in a marriage, it's typically the wife likes one type of wine, the husband likes another. That's great. You can buy two bottles of wine. It's perfect. But follow your own palate, and then it'll guide you. One of my epiphanies was discovering Grenache. I absolutely love Grenache, and I started making it. I started looking all around California for what I thought were the best places, and it became sort of my homework, and it was great because I would buy half a case, two cases of Grenache, so I could really get my head and tongue around the whole thing. So after that, I would find a region, then find a grower, start talking to those folks, and that's when that courtship that I alluded to happened. And sometimes it is a trial period, and more often than not, you win them over because you're super passionate, you're committed, they see you every weekend, you want to hang out with them, they're good people, and it's the magic. That's follow your passion, follow your palate, and I think people will pick up on that.
I do too. We've reached the point in our program where we have time for one more question. How are urban wineries advantageously situated to take advantage of emerging trends in consumer traffic, visitor traffic, purchasing awareness, and brand evangelizing? And things also like winemaking styles and trends, if you could just speak to that.
I, for one, doing events on the weekends, we're right down the street from three restaurants rather, that do brunch. So it's kind of a no-brainer to be open from 2 till 5 p.m. in the afternoon. People have had something to eat, come down and have a glass of wine. Like I said, we've got the ice cream. We've got a new French butcher that opened right around the corner from us. So being part of the neighborhood is not something. If we were on Highway 29 in Napa, that's just one traffic jam after another.
Yeah, the new gourmet ghetto of San Francisco seems to be Dog Patch.
Yes. Quickly approaching.
Well, first there was the locavore, and now we like to believe there's the locapore. So, you know, but people are becoming more attached to the idea of sourcing their food locally, and now wine is beginning to follow on. And, you know, for many years the irony was is that if you looked at a restaurant menu, there was a huge amount of pride in saying their food was locally grown, locally sourced, but they had an all-European wine list, and that's changing very rapidly, and I think that the urban wineries really can take a leadership position there because we are right in the neighborhood. We have that partnership, like Carl describes here, with the restaurants we work with. We're in, you know, we're with each other all the time. So, you know, the whole idea of thinking local, particularly in a world where gasoline is $4 and up, driving somewhere starts to get rather dear. Accessible places that are in your backyard become very important.
For the trend, I think our focus was going to be probably more on the keg wine and tap wine. So even though you won't see the Temescal Creek label in your local Safeway, you might find us in a restaurant in the near future.
Terrific. Sasha, any final thoughts on how you're going to capitalize on emerging trends?
I don't know. I don't really follow trends because I want to stay pure to who I am. So I don't want to say blatantly disregard it. I'm aware of it, but I don't really embrace it because I want to make wines that I like and I like to drink. And if no one else likes to drink it, that's okay because I'm going to have a great party and you guys are all invited. But, you know, that's why I make what I make. I'm not looking at top 40 or, you know, looking at who's getting the stars, or I don't obsess about the Wine Spectator scores. You know, trust your own palate.
Good advice. Derek?
Yeah, in the spirit of partying, I think this conversation would be better continued next door in the tasting area. Do you all agree?
Yeah. There we go.
Before we wrap up, just a final thank you to our fabulous wine experts / magicians, Derek Rolfe, Sasha Verhage, Chris Lynch, Marilee Schaefer, and Carl Sutton. We also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Courtney Cochran, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.